This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Inequality was already a huge issue in the U.S., but the pandemic has pushed it to new heights. Low-wage workers have been hit hardest by the pandemic's economic fallout. New data from the Labor Department shows that women accounted for most of December's job losses. And as many Americans struggle to pay their bills, billionaires' wealth mushroomed, with the top billionaires adding more than $1 trillion to their collective wealth since the start of the pandemic. So as part of our listener-suggested series, we're digging into the ballooning economic crisis that's accelerating inequality in America. And the person who pitched this idea also wanted us to talk with Dan Price, and thankfully, he could join us today. He's the CEO of Gravity Payments and the author of Worth It, How a $1 Million Pay Cut and a $70,000 Minimum Wage Revealed a Better Way of Doing Business. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
So give us some background on your story. In 2015, you decided to take a $1 million pay cut and raise your employees' minimum wage to $70,000. What brought you to that decision?
Well, it was just the right thing to do, and I put it that plainly and simply because I found that pretty much any 10-year-old knows that the way we're distributing wealth, the way we're distributing resources doesn't make sense. And, you know, it's the employees that really create the wealth and create the success of a company. It's not the CEO. But our system was set up where CEOs and executives make the lion's share of the money. So I was on a hike with a friend named Valerie, and she was explaining to me how a $200 rent increase was making her life completely unlivable. And I was upset, but I realized that 30% of the employees that worked at my company, Gravity Payments, were making less than what Valerie was making. And so I realized that I was really part of the problem more than part of the solution, and I wanted to make a change. And since we did implement the $70,000 minimum wage, and I did take that $1 million pay cut to do it, we've really proven that it can work, because prior to implementing it, we had amongst the staff between 0 and 2 babies born per year. People couldn't afford to buy homes. People were getting into debt. And since we implemented it, we've had a 10X baby boom. We've had 60 babies announced or born. We've had people between double and triple their savings for retirement. 70% have paid down debt. And we've had a 10X boom in first-time homeowners. But what's also true is the business has done just fine, if not flourished. Our employee attrition was cut in half after we implemented a more fair, more reasonable pay schedule for our team. And we are now triple the size that we were just 5.5 years ago.
When you decided to move forward with this plan, did you get any pushback, even internally? Like, we can't manage to, you know, maintain $70,000 salaries for everyone, or was everybody on board?
Yeah, there were two people that spoke out publicly about it, and one said that they thought it would create a culture of entitlement where people were just kind of, you know, there for the paycheck. And the other had objection because she felt like she had worked really hard to get her way to a place where she was making a living wage and a fair wage, and she didn't really think it was fair for other people to be shortcutted closer to where she was. So, you know, we heard those, but the vast majority of employees at the company, even the ones that made a higher level of pay, we heard that they were excited because they didn't need to worry about the financial security of their coworkers anymore. We had our higher paid employees feeling some level of stress that the lower paid employees weren't being taken care of, that they weren't getting what they really deserved when they were the ones adding the value, helping out the higher paid employees and collaborating together. And just because one person works in a job like engineering or sales that traditionally can command a higher income, and somebody else maybe works in a position like answering customer service phone calls that traditionally pays a lower income, those people are still collaborating and working together. So having such an unequal pay scale didn't make sense, and we heard that it was a relief when we changed that.
For the two employees who had some pushback, how did you respond to their concerns, or did you just note it and move ahead?
I mean, I'm still in touch with both of them, and we're still friendly. They both left the company over the decision, and they were quite public about it. But I thought that it made sense. You know, their pushback made sense. It's not a perfect program, And I think that's one thing that we have to get over is we have all these little kind of fights and disputes that we can have, not only at Gravity Payments, but in the broader society about, like, is this exactly fair? Is that exactly fair? But we know that the system overall is so bad, is so poor the way it's designed right now, that making these changes that allow the people really adding the value to have their fair share, it's worth it to go through some of those difficulties. And so in those two specific instances, it's true that it was unfair that that woman, you know, had to work her way up the hard way. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed about that as a CEO, that that happened under my watch. And it's also true that, you know, when you do have a little bit higher sense of pay, people do have a higher sense of self-worth. And with that does come a sense of entitlement. But what also comes with it is a sense of license that I matter, that my voice matters. And people invest in their own capability, which helps them to continue to grow as an individual and not be trapped in poverty, not be trapped spending 50% of their income just paying the rent. And so the criticisms were noted, but also agreed with. But there was a greater reason why I still think it was the right decision.
You know, like a lot of other businesses, your company did experience a hit during the pandemic. And you wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post about your decision to cut employees' pay instead of doing layoffs. Talk about what happened and what led you to that decision.
Well, it was early March, and our revenue just started dropping right away because our revenue is tied to small business revenue. And I think important for us to all pause and reflect on is that this pandemic has hit small businesses so hard and has actually increased the advantage and the revenue and the profitability of many larger businesses. But back to us, you know, because of the fact that our revenue is derived as a percentage of all those small businesses, the 20,000 small businesses that choose Gravity Payments for their payment processing, we lost 55% of our revenue. And we went from having, you know, a modest profitability that would keep us in a safe place to where we were going to be losing $1.5 million a month, and we were going to have 3 to 4 months before we went out of business. And our competitors, one, for example, Toast, responded by laying off 50% of their employees. Another competitor of ours, Heartland, responded by implementing a $100 per month fee on all the small businesses that use their service. And both of those things just seemed like they would really cut at the heart and soul of who we are as a team and who we are as a company. But that having been said, it seemed like those were the only options other than going out of business. And so, you know, I just took that and presented it to the team. And I was honest and transparent about the fact that I could not come up with a solution as the CEO, as the leader of the company, that could take us forward without gutting what we stand for and who we are. And so the team wrestled with it and came back to me with an interesting idea. They said, let's have an anonymous spreadsheet, anonymous so there's no pressure, and see if we can just have people volunteer to recast their own pay and to change around, you know, what we're doing from a job description standpoint to get through the pandemic together. And of course, when I heard that, I thought, well, everyone's going to, you know, think that somebody else is going to take the brunt of it. And so this probably won't work, but let's see how this goes. And I didn't think it would work, to be honest, which I'm embarrassed about. But when I saw the spreadsheet, yeah, my eyes filled with tears, because what I saw was 98% of our 200 employees asked to take voluntary anonymous pay cuts. 10 asked to work completely for free. 30 asked for 50% or more pay cut. But when it all shook out, we, on average, employees asked during the pandemic to cut their own pay by 30%, which extended that runway from 4 months to more like 12. And then we mobilized and started getting all this technology in place to allow the small businesses to reopen and compete like they really should have been able to all along against the large businesses. So things like ordering ahead of time from your cell phone, from your car, from your computer, for every different type of business out there, including veterinarians, doctors, restaurants, coffee houses, all this technology to keep the likes of Uber Eats and DoorDash and Amazon and Walmart and Starbucks at bay and really give the small businesses a fair chance to compete. And by August or September, we were recovered enough. We were still down, but we were recovered enough to restore everybody's pay and back pay everybody for the amount that they had given up during the pandemic. That sacrifice that our employees made, I'll never forget it. And it was so humbling because it was not me that saved the company. It was 100% our employees.
We've only got about a minute here. You've made some very specific decisions as CEO of your company. But do you have other policies or government regulations or taxes that you think would work on a larger scale? I mean, does this model work at a public company?
Well, I think we've proven that it works. I mean, our results speak for themselves. But I think the other thing that we've proven unintentionally is that big companies are not going to follow suit because this data is out there. And yet the big companies are doing the exact opposite. They're doing layoffs. They're doing record bonuses. They're at record valuations. And they continue to cut and lay off employees, cut pay, lay off employees, not really invest. And so, unfortunately, I think we've proven that the only solution will work is not voluntary action like what I took. It's systemic solutions that are forced upon these companies.
That's Dan Price. He's CEO of Gravity Payments, and he's the author of Worth It, How a $1 million Pay Cut and a $70,000 Minimum Wage Revealed a Better Way of Doing Business. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
In a minute, why are we seeing inequality grow and what can we do to address it? I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing the wage gap and growing inequality in the U.S. due to the pandemic. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about inequality in America? Or tell us how you've been affected. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Let's bring in some new voices to analyze the issue. With us, Chuck Collins. He's the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies. That's a progressive think tank in D.C. where he co-edits inequality.org. Chuck, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jen.
Also with us is Kate Bond, Director of Labor Market Policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. It's a left-leaning research and grant-making think tank. Kate, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me. Excited for this conversation.
And Scott Winship is the Director of Poverty Studies and Resident Scholar at American Enterprise Institute. That's a right-leaning think tank in D.C. Scott, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
So when we say the wage gap, Scott, what exactly do we mean by that? And how is it different from income inequality or a wealth gap?
Well, I think that's a great question, which is to say that we sort of have to be precise about what we're talking about when we talk about inequality. The truth of the matter is we're not going to have very good evidence as to whether income or wealth inequality went up significantly in 2020. Really until the Census Bureau releases data in September. And there are reasons to think that wealth inequality may have gone up a bit, but it's not as I would say it's a much more open question than the premise of the show would indicate. And we can talk about the reasons for that. Wage gaps are tricky as well, because the main thing that happened in 2020 is that lower earning workers bore the brunt of employment losses. And what that does is it removes them from the wage data. And so you often during recessions get this weird phenomenon where it looks like wages are rising initially during recessions because the people who had lower wages were more likely to lose their jobs entirely. So I think we just need to be precise about what we're talking about when we say that inequality has grown.
Kate, does it mean something different when we talk about race and gender pay gaps?
Definitely. And this relates to some of what Scott said, that the low-income workers have really had the brunt of job losses in this pandemic. And those workers also are workers who are disproportionately women workers, disproportionately Black workers, disproportionately Hispanic workers. And those workers have lost a lot of their jobs. Related to the broad question of inequality, these workers also were less likely to have wealth to be able to sustain losses in income. So these workers already were in a precarious position, already were marginalized, were less likely to have access to resources to weather crises, and are being hit hardest in this crisis.
Chuck, what do we know so far about how people have been affected broadly during the pandemic? We know there's been job losses, but in terms of, you know, just access to work and wages, how much information do we have so far?
Well, I think Scott is right. We don't have all the data, but we do know that the inequalities that sort of existed prior to the pandemic, I think it's fair to say that the pandemic that those were like the pre-existing condition that our society went into the pandemic. And I think we've seen, you know, high wage jobs come back and rebound. The sort of Zoom economy workers are holding steady, but people who are low wage workers, and those are occupations like food, retail, all the small businesses that have been shuttered, domestic childcare and elder care, you know, those occupations are seeing huge surges in unemployment. That's very racialized. Most of those workers are Black and Latino. So I think it's fair to say we're going to see, I think, an acceleration of inequality, particularly when you, as Kate pointed out, so many households have very little financial reserves. You know, it was 2 years ago when we had the government shutdown and we saw just how many people were living paycheck to paycheck. And then there's the dynamic of wealth concentrating at the top. So, you know, U.S. billionaires, there's 660 of them today. No, their wealth has gone up over $1 trillion since the, you know, a year ago, and over this period of this pandemic. So we're seeing an upsurge of wealth at the top, and growing precariousness for most of the workforce.
Scott, with the understanding that we don't have complete data yet, are there types of inequality that you are concerned about? Types of inequality that have been exacerbated by the pandemic?
Well, so let me just say, I think a key thing that we need to really recognize, and which is really underappreciated about 2020, I'll start by saying I think policymakers did a terrible job last year at controlling the spread of the coronavirus, and that had economic costs. It had costs in terms of lives lost, but they succeeded more than is recognized in expanding the safety net to limit the amount of hardship that families experienced when they lost their jobs. There's really good data by Columbia researchers who showed that the poverty rate in September was something like 16 to 17%, compared with 15 to 16% in January. So that's, you know, a small increase, but certainly much less. They actually show that it's a much smaller increase than would have been the case if not for all of the legislation that the Congress passed in March. There's another study by Notre Dame and University of Chicago researchers that show that 12% of households were poor over the previous 12 months as of November. That was the same level as in November of 2019. There's research by Raj Chetty and researchers at Harvard and Brown University that shows that consumer spending is no lower in low-income zip codes at the end of the year than it was at the start of the year. So there was a real success story last year in terms of the way that the safety net kicked in thanks to policymakers. The real form of inequality that I'm most concerned about is inequality of opportunity. And I think, again, the Chetty team has really good evidence that kids who were attending low-income schools fell behind by a lot over the course of the school year in the spring and probably have continued to do so this fall. That's going to have ramifications down the line for upward mobility. And to me, that's the real tragedy, or one of the real tragedies, but maybe the biggest one of 2020.
Kate, what about for you? I'm thinking specifically about this from this report from the Labor Department about this loss of 140,000 jobs in December, with women accounting for most of them. What's top of mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, what Chuck had said, that we've had longstanding inequality, particularly by demographic backgrounds, that is likely to be really exacerbated in this crisis. And so when we look at things like the gender wage gap, we know one of the biggest factors that helps explain the gender wage gap, I mean, is occupational segregation, where women tend to be crowded into particular occupations, and those occupations tend to pay less. And many of those jobs are these face-to-face service jobs that have had to be limited or greatly changed in face of a public health crisis. And there's been a lot of layoffs in those jobs. And when we have layoffs, it's going to put a downward pressure on wages. And so when we look at the jobs report from last month in particular, I think another really important point to bring up when we're looking at how this is going to affect the gender wage gap is that evidence shows it is really particularly Black women and Hispanic women who made a lot of those job losses. White women actually seem to have gained some jobs last month for whatever reason. We don't have a lot of detail yet about who exactly these white women, Black women, and Hispanic women are. Based on what jobs they're working in. But we do know Black women lost a huge amount of jobs. We know that Hispanic women lost a huge amount of jobs. We also know that Hispanic men lost a lot of jobs. And I think once we start to be able to dig into that data, we're going to find a lot of it is occupational segregation and the types of jobs that workers are doing that have had to be really limited because of the pandemic.
Chuck, Forbes estimates that the world's billionaires have gotten $1.9 trillion richer during the pandemic. What's driving their wealth right now?
Well, and I should say in the United States, U.S. billionaires account for over $1 trillion of that. I mean, I think there's a lot of things driving it, but I think one of the things is that there are companies that have done quite well in the pandemic, in part because they've had their competition shut down. So a lot of Main Street businesses have been shuttered. And if you look at the companies where the billionaires are seeing their wealth surge, they are online retail, cloud-based servicing, the kind of services that allow those companies to extract a little bit of rent from all of us. And they're benefiting from this kind of artificial monopoly that the pandemic's created in terms of shutting down Main Street. So that's where the big surges of wealth are coming from.
We're talking about the wage gap and inequality with Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies, Kate Bond, director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and Scott Winship, director of poverty studies and resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute. Scott, as someone who studies poverty, how does news about billionaire wealth on the rise strike you?
Well, what's interesting is that what tends to happen is that inequality increases during expansions, which are the periods that actually are where poverty declines and where the incomes of the middle class go up. And inequality declines during recessions. What typically happens is that there's a recession, stock prices and housing prices and fall. The top actually sees bigger losses than everyone else does. And then the recovery starts, and the gains at the top are higher than the gains that everybody else gets. 2020, I think, is going to prove to be very similar to that dynamic. The recession was incredibly deep, but the recovery started very quickly relative to typical recessions. The S&P 500 fell 19% between the end of February and the end of March, but then it rose 37%. That kind of gain, which over the entire period is an 11% increase, is pretty consistent over the past few years. And data from the Federal Reserve Board that was released last fall showed that wealth inequality actually fell between 2016 and 2019. So again, even the sorts of gains that are very real at the top don't really tell us that inequality will have grown when all is said and done over the course of 2020.
And specifically, what about wages?
Wages, are, again, much more complicated just because you only observe wages in the data for people who are working. If we assigned $0 of wages to the people who lost their jobs, it's certainly the case that wage inequality increased in 2020. Annual earnings inequality almost surely increased in 2020 as well for the same reason. There we actually will observe some people's earnings because people had jobs in January through March and then lost them and may or may not have gotten them back. And then the trends for income inequality might look completely different because of the safety net and the way that unemployment benefits were expanded in generosity, in duration, and in coverage, the way that SNAP benefits were expanded the way that the Paycheck Protection Program increased support for workers whose businesses had to shut down operations. The $1,200 checks per person that went out, all of these things mitigated the increase in wage and earnings inequality that occurred, so that the increase in income inequality is probably much, much less, if increasing at all.
Kate, I'm curious to hear from you here, because we hear people point to the stock market, but the stock market isn't the economy. And how much of an indicator is the stock market of how people, individuals, are doing?
It is not a great indicator. Most people still are supporting themselves, supporting their families through their jobs, through the wages they make, through the direct employment income they make. So that is not going to affect most people's well-being if the stock market continues to go up. I think what is going to affect people's day-to-day well-being and their financial stability is going to be what happens to wages of workers right now. And when there's high unemployment, particularly when there's high unemployment in some of these low-paid sectors, that is going to put a big downward pressure on wages. We know it makes sense. You're not likely to ask your boss for a raise if you know that your company is downsizing, if you know that there are big layoffs. And so there's likely to be that downward pressure on wages as long as unemployment remains elevated, and as long as unemployment is higher for women, higher for Black workers, higher for Hispanic workers. I think we'll see that downward pressure on wages really exacerbate these wage inequality trends by race and gender.
Chuck, zoom out a bit. Is this a uniquely American problem, or are we seeing this play out globally?
Well, I think we're seeing kind of rising inequality globally at the top end, you know. But I think other countries have done a better job supporting workers through the pandemic. Scott is right. I think the first phase of the pandemic, the sort of April, May, June, government action like unemployment insurance boosting, that really did make a difference. But let's recall, we've pulled those supports out so that the fall, I think one of the things I think we'll look back and we'll see that the fall saw the plight of low-wage workers really struggling. And, you know, there's this phrase, K-shaped recovery, which is, and I think when we talk about reducing inequality or how workers are doing, you know, if you look at the top 20%, the highest income 20%, you know, they're going to bounce back faster. They're going to see their asset prices rise. It's really the bottom 60% that I don't think is going to see any kind of lift, and actually will, I think, lose ground coming out of this fall when Congress waited so long to kind of come up with a second relief bill.
Kate, how do workers' rights and safety play into these conversations about the pay gap and inequality?
The long-term research has shown that declining worker power has contributed to this rise in income inequality. You know, and as I mentioned before, when unemployment is high, workers are going to have lower levels of bargaining power because they have fewer outside options. So without worker power, it is really hard for workers to ensure that they can get raises that are commensurate with the value they're contributing. And it's hard for them to get those types of job protections that they need. And then particularly in this crisis, they need ever more job protections because they are working through a pandemic, particularly if they're doing face-to-face work. So what I've been thinking about a lot is the degree to which we need to make sure we are not shying away from the types of policies that make sure workers are in high-quality jobs that pay a fair wage, because we want to make sure that the effects of the recession that tend to make jobs worse quality is not happening right now, particularly as it poses just, you know, a physical risk to workers to go to work in a pandemic. They should be paid fairly for taking on that risk, and they should make sure that they are able to, you know, go to their bosses if things feel unsafe, go to the authorities if they think things are unsafe at work. So they need bargaining power, and they need to be sure that they won't be retaliated against in order to be able to do those things.
We're discussing the wage gap and inequality with Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies, Kate Bond, director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and Scott Winship, director of poverty studies and resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute. We're also hearing from you. Kate tweets, I offered to take a pay cut when our small business was first shut down during COVID. I work with women who donate plasma to make extra cash on the side, and these women do tons of work. They make less than me because of my degree and skill, but they are just as important. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. Now let's get back to our conversation on the wage gap and inequality during the pandemic. With us, Chuck Collins, the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies. That's a progressive think tank in D.C. where he co-edits inequality.org. Kate Bond, director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. It's a left-leaning research and grant-making think tank. And Scott Winship, the director of poverty studies and resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute, a right-leaning think tank in D.C. Scott, there were reports that tax breaks and the stimulus benefited big businesses the most, and the same for PPP loans. We are still in the midst of this pandemic. We know that the vaccination plans are moving more slowly than hoped for. With a new administration coming in, what would you hope to see from lawmakers to help people make it through what could still be months and months of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important question. To my mind, you know, getting the economy going again is the most important thing that we could do right now. The pre-pandemic economy was as strong as in the late 1990s boom. Poverty was actually at an all-time low, and middle-class incomes were at an all-time high, according to Census Bureau data. So really, like, our first five priorities ought to be to get back to that economy. And the way that I think you do that is, first of all, to get the spread of the virus under control. You know, we've seen a complete absence of leadership during the Trump administration on this, and I think President Biden will prioritize it much more, and that will be important. I think we probably will end up needing to provide some more aid to small businesses to keep them from closing, so that when we do eradicate or at least control the spread of the virus, that there are still places for people to go to work to at the end. The Paycheck Protection Program, I think, is widely acknowledged that it was not as well targeted as it could have been towards smaller businesses, but it was far, far better than if we'd done nothing. But I do think targeting aid to smaller businesses would be really useful. And I think, you know, I think something that no one's really talking about, but that gets at this issue of inequality of opportunity, is we ought to be thinking about funding for summer school, so that we can help get some compensatory education to kids who really were kind of left behind during virtual learning.
Kate, what about for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, Scott is correct that we definitely need to be looking towards small businesses and making sure that funding is targeted towards keeping small businesses open. It's particularly important to make sure, to the degree we can, to try to keep workers tied to their jobs. It is really disruptive if a worker has to leave their job and then go back to that job or go back to a new job. It just can really offset someone from their earnings trajectory. But we also want to make sure that for workers who are losing their jobs, that we are maintaining really generous and long-term unemployment insurance benefits. Not only is that a really quick and dirty tool to make sure that workers who have lost the most income are getting income support, but there's also evidence that there are long-term benefits to having generous unemployment insurance. There's evidence that shows that unemployment insurance improves job match quality, so that if you are in a stable economic position, it gives you the opportunity to look for a job that is a good match for you. If the job is a good match for you, that's likely the job you're going to be more productive in, and you're going to be able to contribute more to economic growth. And so I really think if we sort of raise the floor on economic well-being and really get money to the folks who need it the most, that is actually going to help us have a much more resilient recovery once we make it to the other end of the pandemic.
Well, we're hearing from lots of people with their ideas for how to improve inequality in the U.S. Steve emails, the most effective way to reduce inequality is to start with a universal basic income. UBI lifts the people at the bottom and near the bottom, a huge majority, with a solid floor to replace the tattered social safety net. Yes, we'll still have the rich and super rich, but that small fraction of the population. And Margaret in Massachusetts says, how about going back to the tax structure under Eisenhower? And this is a theme we're hearing from a lot of folks who think the setup in the 50s and 60s was more equitable. Chuck, first, do you think government regulation can help address inequality in the wage gap?
Actually, I think it's essential. I mean, we're kind of on extreme inequality autopilot. And in addition to the things I think that, you know, Kate and Scott mentioned, we should look at things like antitrust. You know, one of my fears coming out of the pandemic is we're going to have these decimated Main Street businesses, many, many businesses shuttered and many precarious, and these kind of fortified monopolies, a couple hundred mega corporations that not only have a lot of wealth, but power in our political system. So we should look at things like, you know, antitrust legislation. And then we should be looking at, as one of your listeners said, you know, tax policies that restore the progressivity of the tax code. We should even consider something like a windfall billionaire wealth tax to sort of pay to offset some of these expenditures. We have to understand wealth, the concentration of the wealth at the top is about power, and its corrosive effect on our democracy is something we should be concerned about coming out of the pandemic.
Scott, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's just a mistake to focus on reducing inequality as a policy goal. I don't think there's particularly compelling evidence that rising inequality has had negative consequences for the middle class or poor. Not at all clear that gains at the top come at the expense of folks at the bottom. As I said, you know, the periods when inequality is growing tend to be during expansions, which also tend to be better for the middle class and for the poor. So I think pursuing policies that would likely reduce inequality wouldn't actually end up benefiting the poor and middle class. And I think that's probably in the end what everybody cares most about, even if we disagree about the policies that would get us there. So I would tend to focus more on policies to increase economic growth. I think, you know, policies to reduce inequality run the risk of actually stalling economic growth. And I would focus on policies to expand upward mobility of poor kids.
Can you give some specific examples?
Sure. I mean, so I think, you know, I've proposed in the past, for instance, an Office of Opportunity in the White House that would seed local experiments to increase the school readiness of kids, for instance. There are large test score gaps when kids enter kindergarten, and we don't really have effective ways of closing that at this point. So trying to find out ways to do that. I think, you know, expanding support for charter schools would be really important. Finding other pathways to opportunity that don't involve four-year degrees or community colleges. You know, there's a whole variety of policies that I think I would advocate for now, but I would have advocated for this time in 2019 or 2018 as well.
But historically, I'm curious your thoughts, because if I think about things like housing policy in the U.S., the way it was written, it blocks certain groups from being able to acquire wealth by having access to certain loans. Black people were barred from access, things like that. You could argue that the government actually created systems that promoted inequality. So why would they not have a role in correcting that?
I think it's absolutely true that there were groups in the past that their access to wealth was impeded by federal policies. I think that's an injustice that we need to reckon with as a country. But I think we also have to be careful about the unintended consequences of the policies that we pursue. And so, to my mind, something like baby bonds or something, you know, savings accounts for kids that will allow them to attend college down the road, buy a home, other ways of building wealth. Those feel much better targeted towards the issue of helping folks who have been excluded in the past accumulate wealth than simply taxing the rich more heavily. The rich are going to find ways around these taxes as they did in the 1950s and 1960s. It could slow economic growth, which is not going to help anybody's ability to build wealth. So I think it's just a much more complicated set of effects that flow from different policies.
Kate, what would you like to see happen to address this issue specifically for women and people of color?
Sure. And also, you know, just to respectfully disagree with Scott, who I think, you know, him and I agree on a lot of things, but I will say that I disagree with him that I think inequality is bad for economic growth. I think there's evidence that inequality distorts, subverts, and obstructs economic growth. rising inequality has really been on the backs of exploiting workers and increasing corporate power. And I think some of the ways that we can balance that, which would be the exact same things that would help women and workers of color, are, you know, what I would call countervailing power. So that would be things like making it easier for workers to organize unions, even in the face of a recession. That would be things like increasing minimum wages, which would, you know, be a good, effective, blunt tool for raising income so that workers are sharing in the gains of the economic growth that they are helping create. I was really heartened that 30 states did still increase their minimum wages on January 1st, so that we are making sure that we are boosting wages for those at the bottom so that they have more economic security. They're more likely to be able to find good jobs for themselves, to stay in those jobs for a long time. So I think giving workers more power, raising the floor on job quality and pay are really good ways to ensure that workers are sharing in the gains of economic growth once we get to recovery.
Chuck, have we seen any precedent, historical precedent, with the government addressing inequality or the wage gap in direct ways?
Well, I think you sort of alluded to it, Jen. You know, in the 30 years after World War II, the government made massive essentially taxed the wealthy at much more progressive rates and invested in public goods toward the goal of building primarily a white middle class, but, you know, low-cost college, low-cost first-time homebuyer loans, public infrastructure that had kind of positive impacts on the rest of the economy. And the problem was that, obviously, people of color were left behind. A lot of white middle-class families got on the wealth-building train, the express train, and others were left behind. That doesn't mean that program is flawed in the sense that you can tax wealth, tax high incomes, invest in public goods, make sure there's sort of a racial equity audit so that any public policy proposed doesn't worsen inequality, both in terms of racial and class and gender. These are all things that, you know, that we should be looking forward toward. You know, the things that Kate mentioned in terms of lifting the floor are absolutely critical. I think the things that Scott cares about mobility and investing in education and things like that. And I would just say we're not going to get there if with this extraordinary concentration of wealth and power at the top that's essentially captured and distorting our political system. So we have to address the oligarchy or the plutocracy problem, if you will, in the mix.
We're talking to Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies. Also with us, Kate Bond, director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and Scott Winship, director of poverty studies and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We have this question. Here's John from Utah.
I have a rationale for why we desperately need equality, or at least better than we have in terms of income. And that is, for a capitalist system to work, people have to have enough money to spend. It's that disposable income that fuels the economy. Obviously, you're not going to get it with just a few $100, but thousands of dollars, yes.
Chuck, briefly, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, as Scott alluded to, you know, we did some things to lift up income support. So consumer demand through the pandemic held up, and that was in part because unemployment insurance was boosted. And that, you know, increases aggregate demand. And that, as Kate would say, that's one of the reasons why inequality is bad for the economy, because when low and middle income people don't have money in their pocket, it slows the economy. So your caller's right on that. And I think, you know, one of the ways we need to look at it in more of a long term, not just in an emergency response to the pandemic, but how do we lift up low wage workers who went into this pandemic without health insurance, without family medical leave, poverty wages, and, you know, the most fragile segment of the workforce have been at risk the greatest. We need to take a longer term, make a long term commitment to reverse that and lift the floor.
Well, Alyssa says, the system is designed for the precariousness of the positions at the bottom to benefit those at the top. We need huge systemic decisions and an end to austerity and gridlock if those at the top want to continue to live in a peaceful society, because people aren't comfortable enough anymore to just take the abuse. Kate, has the Biden administration signaled to you how it may respond to the wage gap and inequality?
One thing I've been really excited to see, across all progressive candidates' platforms when they're running for president, and particularly the Biden administration as it is gearing up to hit the ground running on January 21st, is really centering these questions of inequality by race and gender. And that will both be, through the offices whose job it is explicitly to do that, like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, who enforces anti-discrimination protections for workers. But they are also looking at the ways in which every single aspect of what we do in terms of our labor policy and how we run different agencies that affect the economic outcomes of workers, that we are looking at how those policies affect workers by gender and race, and we are making sure that we are trying to make things more equitable by gender and race.
That's Kate Bond, Director of Labor Market Policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Also with us today, Chuck Collins, the Director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org, and Scott Winship, Director of Poverty Studies and Resident Scholar at American Enterprise Institute. Chuck, Kate, Scott, thanks for being here today. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.